This is Space Time, Series 27, Episode 36, for broadcast on the 22nd of March, 2024. Coming up on Space Time, measuring the exact mass of the biggest neutron stars. A new Japanese orbital rocket explodes seconds after launch. And downloading NASA's dark matter data from above the clouds. All that and more coming up on Space Time.
Welcome to Space Time with Stuart Gary.
Astronomers have measured the exact upper mass limit of a non-rotating neutron star, a finding that will allow scientists to better understand the physics and evolution of black holes. The observations, reported in the journal Physical Review D, showed that the largest non-rotating neutron stars have masses of around 2.25 times that of our Sun. This provides a pivotal aspect in the study of nuclear physics and astrophysics. The ultimate fate of any star is intrinsically linked to its mass. Stars with less than 8 solar masses, with cores less than 1.44 solar masses, the so-called Chandrasekhar limit, end their life cycle as white dwarfs. That's where our Sun will wind up. They're supported from further collapse by electron degeneracy pressure, where the Pauli exclusion principle prevents identical fermions from occupying the same quantum state at the same time. However, more massive stars can crush through this electron degeneracy pressure limit, crushing the negatively charged electrons into the positively charged protons to form neutrons. But debate still exists around the mass limit, where stars can crush down beyond the neutron star stage to become stellar mass black holes. This involves a process called neutron degeneracy. It produces an extremely compact star composed of nuclear matter, which is predominantly a degenerate neutron gas with a small admixture of degenerate proton and electron gases. The measurements made by scientists from the Purple Mountain Observatory showed that the maximum gravitational mass of a non-rotating neutron star was approximately 2.25 solar masses, with an uncertainty of just 0.07 solar masses. What it means is that for stars heavier than 8 but lighter than 25 solar masses, neutron stars will be produced when they die, which are prevented from further collapse by neutron degeneracy pressure. For non-rotating neutron stars, there's also a critical gravitational mass known as the Oppenheimer limit, above which a neutron star will collapse further, eventually forming a stellar mass black hole. But establishing a precise Oppenheimer limit has been challenging. Three diverse equations of state reconstruction models were employed to mitigate potential systematic errors, yielding almost identical results for critical gravitational mass and the corresponding radius, which by the way is 11.9 kilometers, with an uncertainty of 0.6 kilometers in these three independent equations of state reconstruction approaches. The precise evaluation of the critical gravitational mass carries profound implications for both nuclear and astrophysics. It indicates a moderately stiff equation of state for neutron star matter and suggests that compact objects with masses in the range of 2.5 to 3 solar masses, which have already been detected by LIGO and Virgo gravitational wave observatories, are more likely to be small stellar mass black holes rather than heavy neutron stars. The authors claim that the merger remnants of binary neutron star systems exceeding a total mass of roughly 2.76 solar masses would collapse into black holes, while lighter systems would result in the formation of supermassive neutron stars. This is Space Time. Still to come, a new Japanese rocket explodes seconds after launch, and NASA's new climate satellite blasts into orbit. All that and more still to come on Space Time. A company hoping to become Japan's first privately operated space launch provider has just learned what the famous expression really means when they say space is hard. Tokyo-based Space One has suffered a spectacular failure with its new solid-fuel rocket exploding just seconds after launch. The 18-meter-tall Karios rocket blasted off from the coast of Wakayama region of western Japan carrying a small government test satellite when it suddenly blew apart, raining flaming wreckage and billowing smoke down into the remote mountainous terrain surrounding the launch pad. The company says it detected an issue and ordered the abort code to destroy the rocket, but it hasn't gone into any details as to what actually happened. The launch of the Karios, an ancient Greek word meaning the right moment, had already been postponed 5 times due to technical issues and even a parts shortage problem. Last July, another Japanese rocket engine, the solid-fueled Epsilon S, exploded during a ground test around 50 seconds into the burn. The Epsilon S is designed to be used as a strap-on booster on Japan's new next-generation H-3 rocket, which had its first successful test flight last month from the Tanegashima Space Center at Kagoshima in southern Japan. The H-3 is the successor to the H-2A launch system, which debuted in 2001. It's designed to compete directly against SpaceX's Falcon 9 and could deliver cargo to bases on the moon. Last month's successful launch followed a launch abort exactly a year earlier after an ignition failure left the rocket standing motionless on the pad. However, a second launch attempt a month later saw the H-3 explode in midair shortly after blastoff, with mission managers at JAXA, the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, saying technical issues forced them to issue a self-destruct order. This is Space Time. Still to come, NASA's new climate satellite blasts off into space, and downloading NASA's dark matter data from above the clouds. All that and more still to come on Space Time. NASA's new PACE climate satellite has successfully blasted into orbit on a mission to survey the oceans and atmosphere of a warming planet in never-before-seen detail. SpaceX launched the PACE satellite aboard a Falcon 9 rocket from the Cape Canaveral Space Force base in Florida. The $948 million spacecraft headed south over the Atlantic and into a polar orbit. PACE, which stands for Plankton, Aerosol, Cloud and Ocean Ecosystem Spacecraft, will spend the next 3 years studying the oceans and atmosphere from its 676-kilometer-high perch. Project scientist Jeremy Waddell says the probe will scan the globe daily, providing measurements that will give scientists an unprecedented view of the Earth. The observations will help scientists improve hurricane and severe weather warnings. It'll detail Earth's changes as temperatures rise, and it will better predict when harmful algal blooms are likely to happen. Waddell says currently most Earth observation satellites can see in 7 or 8 different colours. However, PACE will be able to see in over 200 colours, allowing scientists to identify different types of algae in the sea and different kinds of particulate matter in the air. NASA already has more than 24 Earth-observing satellites and instruments in orbit, but PACE is different because it provides better high-resolution data, including new insights into how atmospheric aerosols like pollutants and volcanic ash will interact with sea life like algae and plankton. This report from NASA TV.
One phytoplankton cannot do too much, but so many of them actually control everything we have, our food, our air that we breathe, and our climate. They're just insanely important. I mean, there's many things that are important, but these are insanely important.
Plankton generally doesn't really mean like a taxonomic group of things. Like, you know, we think about mammals and then plants, and plankton are not that. Plankton are really defined by the way they live. Plankton means the wanderer in Greek. And these are just oceanic organisms that really just don't swim that fast that they can fight the ocean currents. It's a really non-traditional way of thinking about biology, in a sense. Plankton, we can define traditionally in zooplankton, so something that is kind of more animal-like, and phytoplankton, something that is more plant-like. All phytoplankton does process that we call photosynthesis. They take carbon dioxide and carbon in organic form, capture some of the sunlight, and then produce carbohydrates, or just simply said sugars, they now are carrying that sun energy and push it into the food system of the ocean. And while they're doing all that stuff, they also produce the oxygen. So opposite from us, we inhale oxygen, exhale carbon dioxide. So that's why they're really important. That's why we love them so much. And that's why they're like really crucial for the whole life on the Earth. phytoplankton itself, its diversity is gigantic. I think there's like 10,000 species, and each of them has a specific role. Why is there so much diversity in something that is so teeny tiny? It's fantasy, science fiction, and horror comes together. I mean, it's just so beautiful. But there's certain type of phytoplankton called coccolithophores, and specifically the most famous one is Emiliania huxleyi. But they take this inorganic carbon to make that something like a shell in which they live in. Their calcium carbonate, which they make, which is pretty much chalk, they make it in a shape of these hubcaps. And if you think about how teeny tiny they are, they're like, you know, I don't know, I can put probably like 30 or 40 or 50 of them in the width of my hair. When they bloom, once they die, not only they take that normal like sugar carbon that they produce, but they also take that calcium carbonate, that inorganic, that chalky material down to the bottom of the ocean. So they're really, really good for exporting carbon, removing it from this contact with the atmosphere, which is really important when it comes to the flow of carbon in the whole, you know, Earth ecosystem, but also control of the carbon in the atmosphere. So Alexandrium is a very specific type of phytoplankton. It's called a dinoflagellate. So it's kind of like maybe plant, maybe zooplankton, maybe animal, maybe it can be both, no? But one thing that it does, it makes this very, 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 very powerful toxin. They're causing problems in Gulf of Maine. Alexandrium, you don't have to have a lot. Actually, really low numbers of Alexandrium can be present and produce really detrimental effect on humanity that feeds on this shellfish. So the changes of the color of the ocean due to the presence of this phytoplankton are just so miniature, no? We cannot see it with our eyes. But if we have sensitive instruments such as ocean color instrument on PACE, we're gonna be able to differentiate not only because it's sensitive to the intensity, but it's also sensitive to the colors. Having this hyperspectral view with really high sensitivity is going to allow me to differentiate much, much more of the phytoplankton because each of them, or at least each group, has its own optical patterns. It's an optical fingerprint. We're hoping that PACE, due to its capabilities, is going to be able to really focus on specific species of interest, such as the harmful algal bloom species or species that are very beneficial for the growth of certain organisms. So this speciation is a function of the technical abilities that PACE has, but it's also, it's a function of our capabilities to understand the local ecosystem.
And in that report from NASA TV, we heard from PACE Science Lead for Ocean Biogeochemistry, Ivana Setanik. This is Space Time. Still to come, downloading NASA's dark matter data set from above the clouds. And later in the science report, a new study tells us where chocolate actually came from. All that and more still to come on Space Time. Data from a NASA mission to map dark matter around galaxy clusters has been saved thanks to a new recovery system designed by scientists at the University of Sydney. The new system allowed the retrieval of gigabytes of information even after communications failed and the balloon-based telescope was badly damaged in the landing process. A report in the journal Aerospace says the recovery was quite an adventure, involving a smashed telescope, a cougar scare, and even the police. Back in April last year, SuperBIT, the Super Pressure Balloon Imaging Telescope, was launched from New Zealand suspended under a helium-filled balloon the size of a sports stadium. It floated around the world high up in the stratosphere at least 5.5 times for the next month or so before eventually coming down to land in southern Argentina. However, the landing didn't go smoothly and the instrument package was badly damaged. The good news is that separately, two data recovery system packages storing more than 200 gigabytes of SuperBIT data and information were ejected to descend by parachute, landing safely, including a map of dark matter around galaxies and stunning photos of space. Dark matter is an invisible substance that makes up 85% of the entire matter in the universe. Scientists know it exists because they can see its interaction gravitationally with normal matter. But they have no idea what it is or how it works. Now, in a typical balloon-based mission like NASA's, data is downloaded by satellite. But scientists often need a line-of-sight communications network in order to download the data quickly, which isn't always efficient or even possible, especially when you're talking about the magnitude of data which this mission managed to achieve. And that's where the University of Sydney's data recovery system came in. The system is composed of two small computers with SD cards to store data. There's also a homemade Find My Phone satellite link and, of course, the parachutes. It's all housed in foam enclosures and uses everyday objects such as chicken roasting bags to keep them waterproof. But it turns out the story of recovering these packages was a mission in itself. Local Argentinian police were called in to help scour the countryside and to retrieve the packages given the rough terrain where they landed. Now, at first, the team couldn't find one of the data packets, and when they did finally find it, they found local cougar tracks in the snow next to it, suggesting that maybe a chicken roast bag wasn't the best idea. This is Space Time. And time now to take another brief look at some of the other stories making news in science this week with the Science Report. A new study shows how climate change's effect on Arctic sea ice is forcing polar bears to find food on land, putting the apex predators at risk of starvation. The findings, reported in the journal Nature Communications, involved scientists placing trackers on 20 polar bears to monitor their daily energy expenditure, as well as changes in their weight, diet behavior, and movement. The authors found that the bears began using different strategies to reduce their energy loss now that there are more ice-free days. This includes fasting, slowing their movements, and eating berries and birds instead of their usual main diet source, which is seals. The authors also found that 19 of the 20 polar bears they studied lost significant mass during their investigation period, which lasted from 2019 to 2022. Scientists are warning that humpback whale numbers are crashing in the North Pacific Ocean. 20 years of whale watching data has shown that humpback whale numbers in the North Pacific Ocean have dropped by 20% in the 10 years between 2012 and 2021. The findings, reported in the Journal of the Royal Society Open Science, says the drop is likely due to a severe marine heat wave which lasted from 2014 to 2016, which reduced food availability for humpbacks. The scientists say humpback whales could be an ecosystem indicator in the face of climate change. A new study says the modern-day cacao tree, whose scientific name means food of the gods, was likely spread from the Amazon basin to other regions of South and Central America, probably along trade routes, and at least 5,000 years ago. The findings, published in the journal Scientific Reports, are based on the discovery of residues of chocolate in ancient vessels. This also showed scientists how different strains of the chocolate tree were bred, suggesting that cacao products were widely used among cultures of people in the region. They found high levels of diversity among the ancient strains, which they suggest means that genetically distinct populations of these trees were being bred together. Peru's Attorney General's office has slammed attempts to pass off two humanoid dolls that mysteriously turned up at Lima Airport back in October as the corpses of a pair of extraterrestrial humanoids. The so-called alien mummies were examined by medical experts and were found to have been fashioned from both human and animal parts. A separate three-fingered hand, believed to be from Peru's Nazca region, was also analysed, with experts ruling out any connection with alien life. The pair had turned up at the Lima Airport office of DHL in a cardboard box and were made to look like mummified bodies dressed in traditional Andean attire. Forensic archaeologist Fabio Estrada from the Institute of Legal Medicine warned that this kind of pseudoscience was distorting real Peruvian history. The dummies were very similar to another pair of allegedly extraterrestrial remains, which were presented in glass cases to dignitaries at the Mexican Chamber of Deputies by a local TV personality last September. The two tiny mummified bodies featured elongated heads and hands with three fingers. They were presented by journalist and UFO enthusiast Jamie Mawson, who claimed the bodies were about 1,000 years old and recovered from Cuzco in 2017. Mawson insisted that these specimens didn't belong to our terrestrial evolution. He claimed DNA testing showed that over 30% of the samples had unknown characteristics not found in any Earth-based species. However, experts later dismissed them as a fraud, possibly mutilated ancient human remains combined with animal parts, but certainly from Earth. Mawson has a bit of a reputation as somewhat of a charlatan, who in 2017 made similar claims in Peru. Tim Mendham from Australian Skeptics says it just goes to show there's one born every minute.
You have to put it in context. Obviously, people have been searching for bodies of aliens for some time, ever since the Roswell supposed crash of a UFO.
They're all in Area 51, we know this.
They're all in Area 51 except for those that are in the Vatican and those that are elsewhere as well. But anyway, so people have been looking for these bodies. Obviously, how well preserved are they? And what's happened recently in Central and South America is that people have presented what is supposedly bodies of aliens. One person last year presented them to the Mexican Parliament, brought them into Parliament.
These are the ones that look like E.T., yeah.
They look a bit like E.T., yeah. They're about ventriloquist dummy size.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a very, very thin, desiccated, a bit sort of snouty, big eyes, scrawny legs and arms.
Three long fingers.
Three fingers as well, yeah. There's various things. They look a bit like they're made out of papier-mâché, but that could be desiccated skin, of course, you know. But no, they look like papier-mâché. Others have actually also presented them. Some were from Chile and others were from Peru, supposedly. Also recently, the Peruvian government, or at least a representative of it, has said sort of, really, that this is sort of silly. What they found was that there has been some investigation of the Peruvian ones, I think.
The Peruvian coroner had a look at them and decided, yeah, well, it's definitely got some animal bones in them.
Yeah, they had wool as well. Wool, polypropylene, rubber, tissue fibres and glue. So none of these sound like particularly alien ingredients. I think it'd be hard-pressed to believe that they were true, especially when they dress them up in little uniforms and things. I think they could be accused more of having bad taste. They look like someone more from a mariachi band in that sort of clothing. But, it's a strange thing that people believe in. Some of the objection that's come out, especially from the Peruvians, is that such a theory of aliens is denigrating the ability of the original inhabitants of the area, suggesting that things like Machu Picchu and the Nazca lines and that sort of stuff have not been man-made but needed aliens to do them. It's sort of like saying, well, the locals are pretty stupid. You needed extraterrestrials to help you do these things. And from a cultural point of view, there's an anti-alien view. But from a scientific point of view, especially from a forensic point of view, you'd think, they don't look that good. They look a bit sort of overly cliched, and all the components of are definitely earthbound. So I think we can clearly say that they are fakes. They're not necessarily very good fakes, and that anyone who believes them should go away and have a cold shower.
That's Tim Mendham from Australian Skeptics. That's the show for now. Spacetime is available every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday through Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, Acast, Amazon Music, Bytes.com, SoundCloud, YouTube, your favorite podcast download provider, and from SpacetimeWithStuartGary.com. Spacetime's also broadcast through the National Science Foundation on Science Zone Radio and on both iHeartRadio and TuneIn Radio. And you can help to support our show by visiting the Spacetime store for a range of promotional merchandising goodies, or by becoming a Spacetime patron, which gives you access to triple episode commercial-free versions of the show, as well as lots of bonus audio content which doesn't go to air, access to our exclusive Facebook group, and other rewards. Just go to spacetimewithstuartgary.com for full details. And if you want more Space Time, please check out our blog, where you'll find all the stuff we couldn't fit in the show, as well as heaps of images, news stories, loads of videos, and things on the web I find interesting or amusing. Just go to spacetimewithstuartgary.tumblr.com. That's all one word, and that's Tumblr without the E. You can also follow us through @StuartGary on Twitter, @SpaceTimeWithStuartGary on Instagram, through our Spacetime YouTube channel. And on Facebook, just go to facebook.com/Spacetime with Stuart Gary.
You've been listening to Spacetime with Stuart Gary. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.